from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Coral on Australia's Great Barrier Reef is failing to recover after a major bleaching event caused by warmer seas in 2017. A recent report found a nearly 90% decline in new baby coral settling on the reef. Joining us this Earth Day to talk about the state of coral reefs worldwide and the research on coral reproduction being done right here in San Francisco is Rebecca Albright. She's curator of invertebrate zoology at the California Academy of Sciences, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day to you. And, you know, coral reefs are something that I know, like me, many of our listeners are very concerned with. And so I want to talk about them with you generally. But I also want to talk about the Great Barrier Reef, because this article appeared in Nature, and we jump on things like this, about all the bleaching that went on there that caused a lot of adult coral reefs to die, but also a decline in the new corals. And that's what's causing some real concern. Seems to be, aren't we talking about climate change here, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the biggest worries at this point with the projections for the future of coral reefs is the frequency that we're seeing these global mass bleaching events occur. The Great Barrier Reef is obviously one of the most iconic systems in the world. It's the largest barrier reef that we have. It's over 2,300 kilometers long, and you can see it from outer space. And the fact that we could have something this catastrophic happen to a system that large in such a short period of time is really sobering to a lot of us in the coral reef community and the general public at large. So we have had three global mass bleaching events that have happened. The first one was in 1998. The second one was in 2010, and the third one started in 2014 and ran.
Is that the cyclones? The 2014 one.
2014 was a series of cyclones. 2014 and 2015, and then on the Great Barrier Reef, it was slammed by back-to-back bleaching events in 2016 and 2017. And one of the biggest concerns was that it's estimated we've lost about 50% of corals over the last 30 years. But the Great Barrier Reef, that 2,300 kilometer system, about 2/3 of that was impacted in a series of 2 years. We've never seen change like that. And that was, it was alarming and sobering. And the study that you're referring to is a follow-up study after these back-to-back bleaching events that said, you know what, if we're losing a third of our corals in that system over a period of a couple of years, what does that do to future populations, to reproduction? And the concerning thing we're seeing is a plummet in the amount of reproduction and recruitment that happens in that system, which is obviously the next generation of corals and implicates recovery dynamics over the next decades.
Well, plus the corals are so integral to biodiversity and so necessary for well, all kinds of industries. I mean, fishery industry, obviously, but also, tourism. I mean, we're talking about the Great Barrier Reef and the possibility of losing billions of dollars if this too-big-to-fail reef actually goes down. And this is not just a canary in a coal mine. This is the canary in the coal mine for so many of the ecosystems. And I think there's really important emphasis here that needs to be placed on how singularly significant this is for not only the environmentalists, but for all of us. Let's talk a little bit about bleaching, though, and what happens with this. They lose their color, but they can recover, though it takes, in some instances, about a decade. And as far as the Great Barrier Reef, my understanding is most of this is in the north, but the south, not so much.
Correct. So in the most recent bleaching event, the 2016-2017, the upper 2/3 of the system was impacted by that. So we have the northern Great Barrier Reef and the central Great Barrier Reef that was impacted. The southern Great Barrier Reef actually fared pretty well in those events. And so in these the study that you referenced with the recruitment, that area looks like it's really healthy right now. But one of the problems is that the currents off the east coast of Australia flow north to south. And so the potential for that southern healthy part of the Great Barrier Reef to repopulate the northern parts is very low. And so how are we going to get the northern 2/3 back is the concern right now.
And I want to give the figure just so people know. We're talking about a $4.5 billion economy boost to the Australian economy that's tied to the Great Barrier Reef.
Absolutely. And globally, coral reefs are estimated to bring in around $400 billion a year in ecosystem services. And that's through fisheries, tourism, supporting scuba diving, coastal protection. It's estimated that that an intact area of reef actually mitigates 97% of wave energy in terms of protecting human livelihoods and coastal infrastructure. So these ecosystems are offering us unparalleled ecosystem services that we're risk losing right now.
And they're like the rainforests of the ocean. I mean, people have to get in step with just how important they are and how vital they are and necessary. And they're also beautiful. I mean, just aesthetically, to talk about that, we're talking with Rebecca Albright, who is curator of invertebrate zoology at the California Academy of Sciences. And it's about really, we're talking about the world's coral reefs and the Great Barrier Reef and efforts to restore them. And let's go to restoration, because some pretty exciting things are going on. And I'm reading about robots and 3D things going on. And you've been working in your lab over at the California Academy with essentially seeing to it that different ways of restoration could take place through changing the reproduction. My understanding is that you've got reproduction going on about once a year now, and you're trying to work it toward twice a year. How does that figure?
Yeah, so right now at the California Academy, we have an initiative called Hope for Reefs, and we're doing a bunch of different things. But one of them is to try to understand how to facilitate this reproductive cycle. How do we get more corals out onto the reef faster? And so corals, most corals usually only spawn or reproduce sexually once a year. And that's really limiting in terms of trying to help a population recover from damage. And so one of the ways that we do this is by partnering with nonprofits called SeaCore, which stands for Sexual Core Reproduction. And in the field, we actually go out during that annual event and we collect eggs and sperm. We bring them back into the lab, we fertilize them, and then we grow out baby corals and plant them back out onto the reef. And something we're doing here in San Francisco, where we don't have proximate coral reefs, is actually trying to spawn corals in the lab. And it's really exciting because it's something that's only been done a couple of places in the world, and we're the first place in the U.S. to do it. And so what we have to do, because it only happens once a year, is mimic this hierarchy of environmental cues that trigger or elicit this annual reproductive event. And that includes mimicking seasonal cycles, changes in sea surface temperature throughout the year. We have to mimic lunar phases, new moons and full moons, sunrises and sunsets to try to get these organisms to spawn. And we've done this 2 years in a row now, which is really exciting. And the hope is moving forward that we could create a couple of these systems and stagger them so that we have spawning several times a year. And that gives us more opportunities for research and more opportunities for restoration.
Well, something needs to be done on a massive scale, because we're suffering massive bleaching around the world, and climate change is not the only factor. Pollution is also very much a part of this. Let's talk about what I mentioned before, though, the robots and the 3D printing to help out.
Yeah, there's a lot. It's funny because a couple of years ago, after these catastrophic events, I would get asked a lot, how do you maintain any semblance of optimism in this? And that was a really hard answer to question to answer at the time. And now it's actually, I do have a lot of hope, because, I mean, there's this saying that necessity is the mother of invention. And that's where we are right now.
Invention as well as virtue, yeah.
That's where we are. And so we're turning towards integrating tech solutions. And so there's a lot of ideas around, right now we're trying to 3D print substrates that are self-stabilizing so that we can seed them with baby corals and throw them out onto reefs. They sink down to the ocean floor and they're self-stabilizing. And is that one way to scale these restoration efforts? Using robotics, underwater drones to outplant these things. There's all sorts of, we're starting to work at that interface between disciplines, which is looking very promising right now.
It's good to hear, because a lot of the projections have said they could be gone by 2050 at the present rate that they're going. And let me hear from our listeners on this. We're talking with Rebecca Albright. She's curator of invertebrate zoology at the Academy of Science here in California Academy of Science. And you can give us a call and let us know your thoughts or any questions you might have, and you can do that now at our toll-free number. Join us at 866-733-6786. The number again for your calls is 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org, or go to our website at kqed.org/forum. And let's talk about some of these projections if we could, because no obituary yet, but they're pretty grim.
They are. So there was a special report released last fall. Well, as I said before, it's estimated we've lost about 50% of the world's corals in the last 30 years. So moving forward, there was a special report released by the United Nations, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, last fall, that looked at this target for climate policy of trying to cap global warming to 1.5 degrees. We're on track right now to reach 3 degrees Celsius by 2100. And so this report
at 2, we lose everything with the corals, right?
With corals at 2 degrees, we lose around 99%.
Yeah.
At 1.5, we lose between 70 and 90%. So this is what we're fighting for. And these bleaching events that you referred to that take about 10 to 15 years to recover from, we are projected to have them annually by the year 2040.
But the ones who survived the cyclone turn out to be more resilient even, don't they?
There's a lot of variability in the system, and that is one of the things that gives us hope. There are species that have different sensitivities. Within a species, there are individuals. And so what we're doing is losing diversity, but there definitely are individuals and species that are able to cope with the stress better than others.
Can we talk about the algae here? Because they provide not only the food for the corals and the bright colors, but how does that work? I mean, when the algae... gets under the coral skin, so to speak. I mean,
yeah.
There's toxic chemicals and then they release, yeah?
Yeah. So actually what a lot of people don't understand is how dynamic corals are. So it's an animal that actually hosts in its tissue an endosymbiotic algae. And corals are notorious for living in these clear waters. And the reason they're so clear is that there's not a whole lot in those waters. And so in order to feed, they have these algae that live inside of them that photosynthesize and provide up to 90% of the food that the corals need. And so in a bleaching event, the animal gets stressed. It's a stress response. And what happens is those algae start releasing reactive oxygen species, oxygen radicals, things like that. And the animal can't cope with that stress. And so much like we would if we get food poisoning or something, we do the quickest thing to try to get that out of our body. So they purge it. They release it into the water column. And what they've just done is release their primary food source. And if they can't get that back within a certain amount of time, they effectively starve to death. And the algae is what gives the coral its color because they're brown. And so when it releases it, it looks like this animal just turned from a brownish color to stark white. And that's why we call it bleaching, because it looks like it's literally been dipped in bleach.
Again, we're talking to Rebecca Albright, and we're talking about corals, future of corals, and what can be done and what ought to be done and needs to be done. And also talking about the Great Barrier Reef. And you are welcome to join us at our toll-free number. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. And we go to a caller in San Leandro. Alejandro, good morning. Alejandro, yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Appreciate it.
Sure.
This is a great topic because, you know, like my husband and I love, we both love going snorkeling all over the world. And we were actually thinking of going to Australia. But I've heard about the news and we changed our minds. But in the last 5 years, I've also gone to the Philippines. I was born and raised there. And I was really amazed of the healthy coral reefs that they have over there. I mean, I have not seen such beautiful coral reefs. So I'm wondering, has that affected, the Philippines has been affected at all by the, you know, warming waters and stuff? Because it doesn't seem like it when we were there.
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's really very few places in the world that have been not impacted by these warming waters. In the last bleaching events, it was estimated that over 70% of the reefs worldwide were impacted by those 2016-2017 events. But as you mentioned, there are these bright spots. There are great areas that have been heavily protected. The Philippines, there was a new marine park that was in Tingloy in the Verde Island Passage that was, it was announced last year. And part of that was due to a team at the Cal Academy that was really rallying for this protection in these high biodiversity areas. So what we tend to see is that areas that have a legacy of better protection, less pollution, less overfishing, tend to fare better in terms of global warming impacts because they don't have all of these stressors hitting them simultaneously. So I think it's wonderful that you were able to see one of these bright spots in the Philippines.
And thank you for the call, Alejandro. Could you talk a little bit about the impact tourism has on the health of coral reefs?
Yeah, tourism. So one of the one of, there's a lot of different impacts. There's layers of this. So there's a lot of publicity recently about the impact of sunscreens on coral reefs, the impact of potentially irresponsible divers kicking the reef, handling the reef, things like that. You have boats that are visiting these sites every single day. And what we do know is that areas that are protected and don't see those impacts do fare better. That said, there is definitely a capacity or a component of education around this. And people, something that you have near and dear to your heart, you are more informed about and you're more likely to protect. And so there's this balance that we need to strike between facilitating tourism to these areas so that they're not so out of sight, out of mind, but also doing it in a really responsible way so that we minimize our impact.
Well, there was and still is a movement of ecotourism and, you know, trying to get not only tourists to see things ecologically that will make them smarter about the environment, but also maybe even screen the right tourists to go to the reefs as opposed to, or to the corals, as opposed to those who might be a little bit more out of it. Or in fact, even sometimes a little bit of education doesn't hurt beforehand.
Yeah, there are some places like in Belize, for example, you actually have to pay a fee when you go diving, and that fee goes back into supporting the marine park. And in some places, you actually have to do a buoyancy test before they'll even ever let you dive on the reef to demonstrate that you're not going to have incorrect buoyancy and actually run into the reef or break off a piece of it. And so some areas are really heavily protected in terms of who they'll allow.
Here's Mark, who writes, France 24 ran an encouraging story yesterday on research being done at King Abdullah University in Saudi Arabia. Saudi and American scientists there are trying to determine how some coral in the Red Sea managed to survive warmer temperatures than coral elsewhere, in the hope that this ability might be transferred to the rest of the world's oceans.
Yeah, so one of the things right now that's being looked at, like we said, there are these areas where we know, and it has to do with local adaptation. So areas that historically are a lot warmer than others, like the Red Sea, where you annually will see temperatures around 33, 34, 35 degrees Celsius, those corals are adapted to that environment. They don't bleach at those temperatures like other areas do. And so there's a lot of talk about, well, could we selectively breed those animals and then outplant them all over the world and create bleaching-resistant reefs? A lot of what we know is that association has developed. Those animals have adapted over decades, centuries, a very long time, and moving them is probably not going to be the answer to the solution or the solution to that question. But manipulating those algal animal associations that we were referring to earlier is an active area of research. So the algae that inhabit the coral actually infer, in some cases, thermal tolerance. And the algae are much easier to evolve in a lab. And so the animal actually has a generation time of 10, 15, 20 years. The algae has a generation time of days to weeks. And so can we evolve algae that are more thermally tolerant and inoculate a coral and then seed those out onto reefs in order to try to enhance the thermal tolerance of a coral reef? These are the types of things that are being looked at right now.
And we'll look at some more callers. Joining us from Hollister is Yuri. Good morning. You're on the air, Yuri.
Hey, thank you for taking the call. I have a question because I'm listening to what you're describing, and I keep thinking, is this a place where the role of genetic engineering could have a big impact if we could figure out a way to create corals that are more impervious to the things that are currently threatening the native population?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for that comment. And it is an active area of research right now. And so there's, out of the University of Hawaii and the Australian Institute of Marine Science, there are a lot of people that are doing, just as you mentioned, some genetic engineering approaches. There's four different ways that that's taking place right now. Selective breeding is one of them. Actually manipulating the algae, like we just talked about. So it's evolving algal strains and then inoculating corals. Another one is actually genetic engineering of the animal itself. And so there are people that are looking at CRISPR and Cas9, and can you do different
CRISPR seems a natural for this.
Can you do gene editing techniques in order to figure out what it is in that pathway that causes bleaching, and then perhaps edit that pathway to enhance thermal tolerance? There's all sorts of things that are being looked at right now.
But in the meantime, we're in a race, aren't we?
We are. And so all of these, there's no singular solution. We're trying to attack this from all different angles. And a lot of them aren't really ready to be, they're not field ready yet. And so they're
not ready for prime time.
Not ready for prime time, no. And so the real solution at this point is addressing climate, and we're trying a lot of things in the meantime to buy ourselves time.
David asks, what good will it do to reintroduce coral into an ecosystem that cannot sustain it? Won't the system still be toxic and kill off whatever is introduced?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's why we're looking at these techniques to see if we can selectively introduce organisms that are hardier. And so there's a couple of different ways you can tackle that. You can either try to modify the organisms or selectively breed ones that did survive in that environment because you know they're a little bit more robust. Or you can just try to tackle it by numbers, which some restoration organizations do, and try to put out tons and tons of corals, knowing that some of them will be forsaken. But hopefully it will be a band-aid that'll buy you a little bit of time moving forwards.
Again, we're talking with Rebecca Albright. She's curator of invertebrate zoology at the California Academy of Sciences. And let me go to another caller here, and that's Joe. Joe, welcome.
Hi. Yes, I'm from Guam. I'm Chamorro, Guam and Marianas Islands, and I was just there last year. The corals seemed kind of robust, but I think there were areas that seemed a little dead. And because Guam is U.S. soil, I was just wondering, for one, does Cal Academy do anything on the island? Because there's a very robust UOG marine lab and sciences curriculum or department. So, and the other part of it is that the military has been there for so long, and, you know, there have been reports of military dumping around Guam's waters.
Mm-hmm.
So how has that affected the coral? Is there anything good right now that's happening with the coral? And is there a hope for our coral if it's been compromised?
Well, first, Rebecca Albright, how familiar are you with Guam and what's going on with the coral there?
I'm a little bit familiar. It is a place that the Academy has worked a bit in the past. We do have a partnership with this nonprofit Sea Corps that I mentioned before, who's a restoration organization, and they're based heavily in the Caribbean, but we are trying to expand to the Indo-Pacific, and one of the initial sites was Guam, with the idea of doing restoration around coral spawning in Guam waters. Like you mentioned, there's a lot of, it's a complex problem. There's a lot of different factors that are impacting the environment in Guam. And I think addressing those through policy on the ground and trying to get the ecosystem a little healthier to begin with would make those restoration efforts more successful. But it is an area that is on the minds of everybody in terms of how do we increase our effort in that area in order to try to boost coral health.
Let me thank Joe for the call. I'll go to more calls in just a moment. But we were talking before about such things as CRISPR, which is essentially gene editing. Aren't there, at this point, scientists working, trying to essentially breed super coral that can survive?
There are. Most of those studies are happening out of Hawaii and Australia right now, but a lot of places are increasing their interest in that area. It's very heavily permitted. And so a lot of these, like I mentioned, are not field ready right now. So what's happening in the lab, there's some exciting results. But these organisms are very heavily regulated, as you can imagine. And so humans have a legacy of unintentional ecological consequences when we try to make things better. And so actually taking an organism that you've genetically engineered and then outplanting into the wild is something that we're not quite there yet. Whether we'll get there in the next 5, 10, 20 years, I don't know. But what we would say is that it's really important that we're doing the research now so that when we do get to the point that we are allowed to do it and we need it in the field, we have the solution in our back pocket.
We sure need restoration. That is the
Absolutely.
Bottom line here. And let me get another caller aboard here, and that's Chris. Chris, join us. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Dr. Albright. This is Chris from Albany. I'm calling, given that we are under such an aggressive timeline, is there anything on the shorter time horizon, like 6 to 12 months, that would be ready for the field? We hear a lot about drone planting, propagation at scale, anything like that?
Well, a lot of what's being done right now in the field is trying to enhance corals that are already there. So in terms of breeding animals that already exist in nature, that's being done all over the world right now. There are restoration efforts that use both asexual, so corals reproduce asexually, where you can actually fragment them, and much like a starfish, when it loses a limb, it'll regenerate. And so there are coral farms, coral nurseries that are fragmenting and breeding corals that already exist in nature to produce them in mass, and then plant them back out onto a reef in order to increase coral cover and enhance overall health of the reef. That's being done all around the world. There are about 90 different coral species that are actively being restored. And then there are also organizations that are doing restoration by facilitating sexual reproduction, which gets at this genetic diversity component that we need so desperately in order to combat all the environmental changes we're seeing. And so, as I mentioned before, we go out into the field during these spawning events and we try to facilitate it however we can. We know that about over 90% of the spawn that's released is usually eaten. It's usually predated upon or dies in the field. So we collect that. We bring it into the lab. We fertilize them. We get 100% fertilization success, maximize settleship or settlement and survivorship, and then plant those animals back out. Those are all natural organisms. What is the part that we are not yet able to do is manipulate the organisms and put them back out. But there are active restoration things happening all over the world that are giving us pretty exciting results.
And let me thank Chris for the call. I wonder if this is a little bit maybe in the weeds, but I was reading, I'm sure you're familiar with this, about this lawsuit at James Cook University down under, a firing of a professor by the name of Peter Ridd, who was challenging the science on the effect of bleaching and essentially saying he was going against it, and he was claiming he had academic freedom and he should have been protected and so forth. It's a complicated case, but the essential thing that I wanted to ask you is whether this kind of thing can actually affect research, because he was doing some original research, and he was, I mean, there was some original research being done, and he was challenging the research.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is... it's a question really of scientific intellectual freedom and scientific freedom. I mean, we do need people that are challenging frontiers across the spectrum right now with coral research, but we also need people that are, I don't think it's an anomalous example that we have someone that's challenging something that's in the scientific frontier right now. We have people.
Well, people are still challenging climate change. I mean, a lot of people are challenging climate change, including
absolutely.
Probably the President of the United States.
And even with restoration, it's a very polarized field. So you get people that say restoration is the right thing to do. And in the same group, you get people that say, no, it's a head fake away from what we really need to do, which is attacking climate change. And we shouldn't be diverting energy away from that. And so I don't think it's an anomalous instance that you have someone that is detracting or providing any sort of skepticism around something.
Well, here's a good tweet to conclude our conversation with you this morning, Rebecca Albright. Olivia says, the guest and everyone working directly on this issue are examples of unsung heroes. Without this work, where would we be today? Worse in 10 to 20 years. Mm-hmm. We'll leave it there. Good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And continue on, please. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And you can, indeed, you, our listeners, can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. We encourage you to do that. And thank you for being a part of this morning's program and for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.